It is a great pleasure to welcome one of the great gentlemen of rock and roll, Mr. Charlie Watts, who drums for the Rolling Stones. Good day, sir.
Good day.
Pleasure to have you here. You've said that your most vivid memory of the summer of 1971 in the south of France was the recording process. What do you recall about it?
Did I say that?
Well, I read it somewhere.
I don't think I never said that. Vivid memory? Well, the memory of it is being in the cellar at Keith's house at Nelcott. But I also moved to France, so I have other memories of France. But, yeah, that one, yeah, the cellar. And I lived at Keith's in the house. I lived above the studio.
Because you had like a 6.5-7 hour drive from the house you rented. Why did you rent so far
away? I didn't rent.
Away?
I bought a house.
Oh, you bought it, I
still
see.
Got it.
Do you?
It's a farm.
Ah.
Yeah. Okay. Bill Wyman and myself bought houses in France.
I see.
So, I lived in a very beautiful part of France, but it was 7 hours away from where we had the truck, which is where we recorded. So I used to go on Mondays and leave Friday or something. Uh-huh. I used to go home for the weekends, actually.
The recording engineer, Andy Johns, said that while looking at the basement, he looked around in the basement at Keith's house and said, this could be a little difficult. And it turned out, in fact, to be a little difficult, right?
I don't really remember the difficulties. It was more, I think it was a difficulty for him. Bear in mind, he's a sound engineer. For me, it wasn't particularly difficult. The only difficulty, in a way, was you couldn't see anyone you were playing with a lot of times.
And didn't he have to run back and forth between the recording truck to say start now or something like that?
Yeah, but we didn't. It's not like now. The communication thing wasn't as instant and as good in those days. And where we were situated wasn't easy for that to happen. So, it was a lot of running up and down stairs to say readies. You know, the foldback wasn't very good either, I remember. But, if we didn't like this bit, you'd move to another bit over there and the guitar amps would come in here, you know. So it was, in a way, it was good because there's lots of rooms down, there's lots of areas down there.
Now, Jimmy Miller was your producer then. He was also a percussionist and he had done several albums before and one after. Being a percussionist, did that help you as a drummer or did he learn from you or did you learn from him or was it both?
I don't know if he learned from me, but Jimmy, for me, A, was one of the best producers we'd had. And for me, he taught me how to record, actually.
How?
Or I learned how to record, but being with Jimmy... it's difficult to talk about if you're not actually playing, standing there.
But just technique.
It's consistency, regularly consistency, and I don't know. I learned an awful lot with Jimmy. Because he was a drummer, percussionist, I learned an awful lot. And he made me better than I was when I first met him, I think.
On Tumbling Dice, that song apparently had quite a long life. In fact, again, engineer Andy John said that there were actually dozens of reels of tape when you were done with it for that one song alone. Do you recall anything about that song?
No. Huh. No, I remember Jimmy and I played, we both played on that.
Because in John Perry's book on the making of Exile on Main Street, he writes, it's songs like this that the Rolling Stones were put on earth for. What do you think of that?
The Tumbling Dice?
Yeah.
Wow. Dear. No, I don't know.
It started actually as Good Time Woman, which is also on the alternative takes that are being re-released.
That, yeah.
And apparently the tempo when it was Good Time Woman was 120 beats per minute, but when it went down to the other, it was 110. I don't know if that makes a difference from your perspective or not in terms of...
It usually makes a difference with the sound you get. The slower you get, you can get a bigger sound on the drums. Mm. I mean, not today with the Pro Tools and all that, but I mean, in those days, you could get... the slower the thing is, the drum, it gives you time for the drum to breathe, so it's bigger sound. Mm. The beats will be bigger. So sometimes they sound better when the lyrics go on as well because the lyrics don't sound rushed.
Mm-hmm.
So... sometimes a track is better slower.
Did you think
but whether I've got no idea whether it was 300 and something. And we did loads of versions of these songs as well. We always do, you know.
In your own mind, did you hear Tumbling Dice as being the first single, which it eventually turned out to be?
No, I never listened to that. I've never done that. We haven't done that since, gosh, the first few sessions we did, where we actually did a single. I mean, for me, we've always done albums, mid-60s, they were always albums. And they pull a single off it. So and a lot of times it's really nothing to do with me. You know, I would say, yes, I like that, or whatever. But it's up to Mick and Keith, usually.
There's a gentleman, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, Dominic Tarl, who put together the book of photos. Is it Tarl or Tarly?
He was a photographer there.
Right. Well, Dominic Tarl, his book of photos, Exile, kind of captured that time. And while some people described that time in the south of France as, you know, nothing short of madness, he said, we were all young, and it was a time of great freedom and energy and creativity. For me, it was a kind of rock and roll heaven. Was it for you?
Well, no, because I was working, and I didn't really... It was what I did, you know. It's no different to what I did in London or what I was going to do in Los Angeles when we went there, you know. We went on tour when the record finished, you know. It wasn't like that's that, you know. It's what I did.
Right.
and all that crap about rock and roll heaven. To an outsider, it may well have been. To me, it's like, I don't know. That's how we live, you know. It's like, you know, they go on about Keith and everything, but, he was sitting there on the settee, you know. It wasn't no big deal, you know. It's just what, I don't know, you know. I lived there, I played there, and I went home at the weekend and came back. Sorry to ruin the illusion, but, you know, and I've never been a rock and roll heaven person anyway.
Okay. How long did the actual exile last in terms of the taxes? You say you still
for
have
me,
your home. Well, for the bulk of
10
you,
years.
Okay.
Mine. I moved to France and that was it. And then I came back in 80-something.
Okay.
So I lived in France for 10 years, but Mick, I don't know what he is, he's a year or so, I think. But, you know, we always never anywhere, really. He's never anywhere anyway, longer than a week.
Right.
Keith's more stable now, of being somewhere. And, you know, I've always been like that.
In the basement, much has been made of the basement at Nelcott. Apparently the heat and the humidity were quite intense at various times, and Ventilator Blues is a great example of that on the album. I think Mick Taylor sort of started the idea of that, because apparently there was only one fan in the basement. Was it near you, that fan?
Ventilator Blues. I can't remember. Bobby Keys dreamed up the rhythm of that.
Huh.
He stood right next to me clapping when we made that track.
Was it hot, though, down there in that basement?
Must have been, I think, looking at the photos. Huh. I can't remember. It's so long ago.
You've described, and in the film Stones in Exile, you also say this about Keith. Your words about Keith on how he works, in a quote from you, play it 20 times, marinade, play it another 20 times. He knows what he likes, but he's very loose.
Yeah. Well, he is. Loose to play with.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he does know what he likes.
Now, here's a question I've been wanting to ask you, because guitar players, and I've interviewed a number over the years, almost to a man, will have their favorite instrument or a series of favorite instruments, but we never hear drummers talk about a favorite set of theirs, a favorite drum kit.
Well,
do you have?
You haven't spoken to me and Jim Keltner, have you?
I have not. This is my first opportunity.
It will go on for weeks.
Do you have a couple of favorite drum kits?
I have a lot of drum kits.
I have a lot of
iconic drum kits I've landed up with at this stage in my life. I have a lot of beautiful old drums. I have the one kit I use all the time, which is a 1957 Round Badge Gretsch. I mean, it's ridiculously old-fashioned.
Huh.
But it's the instruments I play, you know. I have a lot of old drums. Most of my drums are old ones. Hmm. And a lot of them belong to famous drummers throughout the years.
Very cool.
Collect them.
What's your most eclectic one, would you say?
The most, would be Sonny Greer's 1940 Leedy drum kit that he used with Duke Ellington.
Wow, very cool.
It is.
I
shouldn't think there's another one in the world. I think It's amazing. And another one is Mel Lewis's drum. I have one of his, which is very beautiful to play, actually. That's a round badge Gretsch, like I play, but it's a wonderful kit, that particular one. I have a lot of them. I have a Slingerland drum kit that originally belonged to Gene Krupa. He gave it to Mel Torme, and Mel Torme had it adapted, and he used to use it in his stage show, in his club shows, because Mel used to play the drums as well in his act, as well as being a great singer. So that's quite a kit, that is. It's one of Gene Krupa's kits that he gave to Mel Torme that now belongs to me.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Regarding the new songs or the unreleased...
I see it didn't last as long as the guitar playing interest.
No, I only...
That's why people don't go on about drums.
If I had the time with you, if I had more than half an hour, I could listen to you talk for half an hour on drums alone, trust me, because I love that style of music as well. I love Frank Sinatra, and I saw you with your big band in Philly a couple of years back, and I would love to talk with you about it, but we have a couple of other areas we have to get to.
Okay, go on then.
In this limited time frame. Mick, regarding some of the new things that have been released from Exile on Main Street, said that when he listened back to the tracks, none of the drums had to be fiddled with in any way. He said they were perfect, which seems like high praise to me.
Well, no. I mean, but also you've got to remember in those days, it was before Pro Tools, as I said, and all that. You know, you had to play a track from beginning to end. You did an intro and a fade or whatever you did at the ending. And it had to be right. The time started at one. You hope it landed up at the end. If you made a mistake, you had to start again. Whereas now there's a lot of bits you can juggle with and whatever, you know. So it was, I don't mean perfect, but they're right. For otherwise we'd have done it again, and that would have been the track you'd have listened to. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So and you know, a lot of times, well, all times, Mick and Keith write a lot of songs, or they write a lot of bits of songs or whatever they do. You know, I play with them, along with them. And sometimes they land up as a track that's actually used on this album that we're working on now, if we were. Or they get put aside. And we have lots of things that have never been used. I didn't know we had this many tracks left over from those sessions anyway.
Well, like Loving Cup comes to mind. Everyone says the drums on that are perfect, and yet you've included an alternate take.
I didn't know that, actually.
You didn't know there was an alternate take?
Well, I'm sure, we do these things. We've done songs all day long sometimes.
But do you remember working on Loving Cup at all?
No. I know the song because we play it still.
Right.
And I know the record because I've listened to it as a guide to what I did then, but no, not really. No, I haven't heard the alternative take. I'm sorry. I have got it, but I haven't heard that version.
Cool.
Has it got vocal on now?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So. Oh, okay. Is it the same as the other one?
It's got a different texture, but...
See, that's what happens, right. A prize example of that is Sympathy for the Devil, But the times we tried that, umpteen times, different ways. First time I heard that song was Mick singing it on acoustic guitar. We weren't even in the studio. He was just singing it. Sounded fantastic. And then we tried it umpteen different ways. And that's what happens with these things, The next time we go in the studio, will happen. You do one thing and you never know.
I wanted to ask you about an idea that I heard was yours. The Stones have a magical... theatrical sense of introducing tours. You've had in recent years everything from the band arriving on a railroad car to a boat to a blimp. But going back to the tour,
the blimp wasn't mine.
I know.
The railway car, the flatbed truck was my idea.
Well, that's what I heard. In 1975, announce the tour of the Americas here in New York City, the press were called to a room. Yeah. There was a table with five microphones, but you guys didn't show up.
That's what they used to do. In New Orleans, play off the back of a truck,
Well, everyone's expecting a press conference with all five members of the Stones, and all of a sudden the windows are open, it's on the ground floor, and they're hearing Brown Sugar coming down the street.
That's right.
And the Rolling Stones are on the back of a flatbed truck coming by, and then they pass the room where all the press is, hop off after the song is done, a huge banner unveils the tour dates, and that was the press conference. Yeah. But the idea was yours.
Well, the flatbed truck was. The whole presentation probably wasn't mine. That was probably Mick by the time it's fine-tuned.
Huh.
Yeah, that but bit.
Bands used to do that in... Was that in the vaudeville era, or was that in the swing era?
In the early... It's where the name Tal... You know, in New Orleans, they had a thing called Talgate trombone playing. Kid Ory was one of those. 1900, around then. They used to play off the back of a truck with it because the trombone was so long. They used to sit on the tail of the truck,
and it would sort of advertise their show. That
well, they'd
as well,
play, right? You know. Sometimes they'd play street parties, So it was just an extension of that. You know.
The last time I interviewed Keith, I asked him about the astounding ovations you've been getting on the tour, the last several tours actually.
Ooh.
And when Mick goes through the various band members and he comes to Charlie Watts, The crowd just goes crazy, and you're so soft-spoken and so humble, but you take a bow. What goes through your head when you get those roaring ovations these days?
Was it bigger than Ronnie Wood's?
I think it was, yes.
Oh, good. That's what goes through my head.
Okay. Keith loved the fact that you're getting such adulation these days.
I never really listened to them. I don't mean I don't listen to Keith. I don't listen to the thing, you know. You can't really hear up there anyway. Not like, you know. And unless you are Ronnie, who stands and waves and all that, it's like, I'm not very good at that. I hate standing up as well.
Huh.
I love being to the end of the show, but I hate walking down the front. And all that.
In addition to the ovation, people on the tours, the fans have speculated, and rumors run rampant, and the band hasn't toured for a couple of years, as to whether, should they tour again, you will join them. Would you?
Why would I not join them?
I don't know. Well, you know, Bill retired after a while.
Ah, oh, poor old sod. There's a reason for Bill retiring. A, he had a dreadful woman he was involved in at the time. Now he's very happily married. And also he got very tired of the road. And he suddenly had a fear of, well, maybe he had it for years, I never knew, but he developed this great fear of flying. And he still doesn't fly anywhere. He has a very good band in England he plays, that tour every year.
The Rhythm Kings, right?
Yeah, they're very good. But he drives everywhere. He won't go on a plane. So it's difficult if you're with the Rolling Stones to get to Sydney unless you go by boat, and that will take about 3 weeks, I think. So it's very difficult to schedule a tour around someone who can't tour. And also he got tired of it, I think. And, you know, that's... If we decide to tour, I mean, I'll be there, I imagine, I hope. If I'm well, you know, fit, you know. It's a lot... The problem with our tours is that... They're so expensive to get together, and the way we do them, that you have to do 50 shows, be on an economic footing, and then, you know, so they're long time, and you just think, that's 2 years, you know. Our tours last 2 years usually.
But you still would embrace touring?
I don't actually think we'd do a 2 year tour as such. I think if we do another one, we'll do one that is this long and see how we go from there.
Right.
I imagine that's how I'd like to look at it. But because when you get that sheet of paper that's got 130 shows on it, you think, I don't look at them, to be honest.
It's too much.
Mick goes through them meticulously because, thank goodness he does, because, you know, you have to know where you go, you know, whether you can make that gig in time and all that. But I personally don't. I can't stand looking at them. It drives you mad. But they're soon over, and it's 2 years later, and you've done it, you know. But it's, I don't know, you know, so it's a big commitment.
It's such great music, though, to keep alive.
Well, yeah, well, I don't look at it like that, you know. I look at it, it's great music to play, you know. I mean, I play now. I was playing last week in Norway. You know, I play with a couple of things, you know. It's not, you know, it's 3 days long and I go home,
right?
or like 3 days long, and I do something that is not to do with the road or anything. When we get together, you know, it's obviously got to be longer. A, you want to make a living at it, and also B, cost so much to put the whole thing together. It's very, very time consuming. If we go on the road next year, Mick will start working now, and he'll ask me to help him. I hope he usually does, and we'll all be thinking of the road next year. So that's that out the window. That's 1 year's work, and then you've got all the physical bit of doing the thing. And they've no doubt they'll have we will have a record. As long as they, Keith and Mick, have written songs, we'll do an album. So that's another thing in there. But it looks a lot, but it's what we do, you know. We've done it, we do it. So, you know, I look forward to playing. I love playing with Keith. I love playing with Mick, you know. It's fun for me. It's hard work, but it's fun.
You had a health scare a couple of years ago with cancer. How is your health these days?
Fine, I hope. I got cleared for 5 years. It was 5 years ago.
Cool. That's great news. My last question to you, sir, is this band is such a family with such a long history of over 40 years now. When you think about it, the ups and downs, Exile on Main Street, everything else that's been contained within those years, what's made this continued wonderful run so possible?
I think people. I tell you, and I've done a few of them, not with this band, thank goodness, but it's hard work to turn up with nobody in the audience. And when you get to the age of 20, it's all right. You get to 30, and when you're 40, you know. That's why I admire jazz musicians an awful lot, because it's an uphill one. That they're so good, you have to be so good to be even asked to go and play. And there's 20 people listening to you. There's no feedback. There's no help to carry on. But we've always been very lucky, you know, we've had. And also, for me, you know, I play with a lot of very good people at what they do. Mick Jagger's the best one at what he does. I think he's the best entertainer, singer in the world. Now Michael Jackson's not here.
And Ronnie,
Ronnie's just great fun to be with, really. And Keith is Keith, you know. I mean, so it's to answer the question a while ago, why shouldn't I be there?
But and, I mean, if you look at the players that you referenced, the jazz players, the blues players, they don't stop at a certain age. B.B. King is in his mid-80s, and he's still playing.
The difference is, and it's entirely up to the artists whether they do it, is that we, unlike a 70-year-old jazz musician who can pick and choose and walk on slowly and do a gig at his own pace, we can't do that. You can't do that. If you're playing at Yankee Stadium, you have to go on there, bang, hit the stage. Also, that's what we've done. It's a two-hour show. Jazz musicians don't play two-hour shows. They might go on for 2 hours, but they wouldn't ask you to book a two-hour show. You know, they don't like that. Mick Jagger works so hard at doing that, what everyone says, God, isn't he great at? Takes a lot of work. And it's what he does, but, you know, it's what it is, really.
When you hear the world's greatest rock and roll band, that phrase, what goes through your head?
Things like Good Golly Miss Molly and things like that. So, I mean, it's very flattering, but for me, there's other greater rock and roll things than that, you know. But then it's difficult for me to see, you know, you've been talking for half an hour, however long we've been going on, boring people, about this record, you know. It doesn't mean the same to me as it does to your audience or you, you know. It's like, I don't know. And also, you do a nice piece of work, which you do, and you hope you like it. You hope other people like it. And that's it, really. I mean, none of us sit and listen, you know. But then you don't, you know. I do that to other people, you know. Probably if I spoke to, I don't know, Fats Domino about you know, walking to New Orleans or Fat Man or something, he'll just say, oh, we did that, you know. And it won't mean the same to him as me when I hear that record, you know. And that's part of the magic of it, really.